issues, real answers, real firefighters. Firehouse.com brings you the leaders of the nation's fire, rescue, and EMS services, the top columnists and educators, and today's most important issues, headlines, and comments. Listen right on your desktop or download and listen on the go to Firehouse.com.
Welcome to the Leaders Toolbox on radio at Firehouse.com. This is the show hosted by Dr. Richard Gassaway. Rich, thank you for joining us today. And if you do have any questions for Rich, please send an email to podcast at firehouse.com.
Thanks for having me, Pete. I got a really special opportunity for our listeners today. I was at the Firehouse Expo in Baltimore, and I had a chance to talk briefly with Mark Emery about some things that he's been writing in the magazines and some classes that he's been teaching, and I was really intrigued by some of the things that he's had to say and write. And I asked Mark if he would be a guest on the show today, and he agreed to, so I'm really pleased to have the listeners know that we're going to have Mark Emery as our guest. Mark's a fourth-generation career firefighter. He serves as the battalion chief of the Woodinville Fire and Life Safety Department. That's near Seattle, up in King County, Washington, known as a very progressive area of the country for the fire services. Mark's just completing his 27th year as a firefighter. As a contributor to Firehouse, Mark has authored the Ten Commandments of Intelligent and Safe Fireground Operations, the Fire Station Pyramid of Success, and he's currently producing a building construction series entitled Fireground Anatomy and Physiology. Mark enjoys contributing to strategic development of fire officers and aspiring fire officers, and I have enjoyed both reading Mark's material and listening to him present, and I think that our guests will have a real treat today. Mark, welcome aboard at the Leader's Toolbox.
Well, thank you, Chief. I appreciate the opportunity to be here. It really is a pleasure and a privilege.
Well, we're going to jump right into the topic, Mark. You have prepared a program that you have presented on aggressive strategy. And when I was looking at the outline for that, it caught my eye as something that I thought would be intriguing. Let's start off by giving you a chance to talk about what strategy is and why is it so important.
I think most fire officers and firefighters know that their strategy tactics and task level activities and firefighters in the fire service is generally very, very good with the tactical side of a incident operation. Let's just stick with the structural fire ground. They're very competent, very aggressive, and very good at task level, operating nozzles, ladders, and a tactical level where you've got to do ventilation or primary search. I think one of the soft spots in the fire service is the strategic side of the fire service. And I like to say the strategy is the hard stuff. Tactics compared to strategy is the easy stuff. And that is because tactics is action, and strategy involves thinking and planning. And thinking and planning by itself doesn't sound all that difficult, but when you couple that with the emotional attachment that comes when the bells hit and you're responding, it's that emotional attachment that makes strategy so hard and tactics so easy. It's not that tactics is necessarily easy, putting up a ladder or operating a chainsaw on a roof, but it's the emotional attachment of the response sequence that really makes strategy difficult.
Mark, is it fair, with how you've described this definition between the two, is it fair to think that maybe we're a little better tacticians because we practice the tactical side of this more often, and therefore it becomes more routines and habits for us and the kind of things that we might do more automatically under stress at an incident compared to strategy?
Well, I think you're exactly right. I'm just thinking of when I was a firefighter and a company officer, we would get every month the training division would assign hose evolutions, and things like that for the companies to do. And looking back on what the training division at that time was assigning was really just a continuation of recruit school activities, where you do a forward lay, you take a hydrant, you squirt water in the parking lot behind the station. And there was never a strategic component to all those years and years and years of evolution and that continuation of the recruit school mentality. And then all of a sudden you've got an incident. And, of course, the evolution that is going through everybody's mind on that fire engine when they arrive is to replicate what you did in the parking lot a week before without the strategic component. And that, you know, some fire departments even time your evolutions, your tactical evolutions, which pushes you that much more into that emotional attachment, non-thinking, just action part of the incident evolution that drives you away from strategy.
Mm-hmm. Now, Mark, the program that you present is called Aggressive Strategy. So we've defined the strategy as the thinking and planning. Let's throw the lead word in and give me a definition of what aggressive strategy means.
Well, by aggressive strategy, first of all, I don't mean like let's say you declare the fire grounds offensive, that the operational mode that you're aggressively going to go offensive. What I'm saying is that needs to happen once you say you're going to be offensive, but prior to declaring that you're offensive or transitional or whatever the operational mode is, that before aggressive tactics, I believe there needs to be aggressive strategy. And I would really like to see the fire service get to the point where they're at least as proud of aggressive strategy as they are as aggressive tactics. And that a tradition be developed from this point forward. And I already see it happening in many different places with many people, including yourself, with emergency scene decision-making and in classes like that, is really about strategic stuff. And that if, you know, 50 years from now when people are looking back, that the history and tradition of the fire service also includes being proud of being an aggressive strategist as a fire officer.
who's responsible for ensuring that aggressive strategy is put into play at an incident scene?
I think it begins, and this is my opinion, but I believe it. I firmly believe what NFPA 1021, Fire Officer 1, the standard for fire officer qualifications, they put the burden on the first officer on scene for the thinking and planning and strategic part of the incident. And in fact, NFPA 1021 says, I'm paraphrasing now, but. And this is Fire Officer 1. This is an entry-level right front seat in a fire engine fire officer, that the first officer on scene develops what they call an initial action plan, and another place they call it preliminary action plan, based on size-up information and whatever your resource, your response capability as it's coming. That in and of itself says that if a fire officer is going to develop an initial action plan, based on size up and resources responding, and then later on it says implement that preliminary plan, that tells me that the expectations as far as the national consensus expectations in the United States is for that first officer on scene to do strategy and not do tactics.
Well, you know, you had talked about your early days, and I think back to my early days and maybe even some of my later days, clearly the company, the focus for the company officer, I think, in their development and in how they have been trained and train others, really is tactical. So is there a method for developing this strategic perspective for this first arriving company officer?
Well, I wish I had a magic bullet I could throw out there. I think any solution starts with an identification of a challenge or a problem. And to me, just looking at it, how I'd like to see things keep transitioning in my fire department, is that when you assign company evolutions, that there are strategic components to those evolutions targeting the fire officer. And, you know, if possible, that maybe a battalion chief, like I'm a shift battalion chief on B shift in Woodinville, that I'm involved in that evolution. And then rather than say we're going to do a blind alley or reverse or forward lay this month, that you say, here's the scenario. You decide which evolution is going to be appropriate. Now, that's strategy. That's making a decision, which is the information that you'll be delivering to us up there in the Pacific Northwest next month. But the that there's a decision-making problem identification component where what happens before the aggressive tactics in that evolution, the firefighters can get going. They can start at task level, but that the fire officer does a size up, maybe goes and picks up a card that says, you know, here's a picture and here's what you see and the status of life safety, call the play. What's the evolution you're going to call? What's your first action is going to be? What's your initial plan and how, you know, what are your the rest of the resources responding? What are they going to be doing? Then once he says, okay, I think for this particular situation, it's best that we do a reverse O's evolution. Then there's a decision-making component. And once they decide that we're going to do a reverse O's evolution, then the officer becomes part of the tactical leader of that team. But the strategic stuff first.
Mark, do the line firefighters need to be concerned with strategy, or can they just keep their focus on tactics?
I think all personnel, and I think that's part of the what do they call that, crew resource?
Crew resource management.
Yeah, there you go. Where they, if they see a problem, that they have to be free to alert somebody to that particular problem and not think that it's not my place, you know, because I'm a rookie to open my mouth. But if they see a problem, that's it's important that that's communicated.
Yeah, well, is it fair to say that the strategy drives the tactics, so that if a company officer or the battalion chief arriving establishes a certain strategy, say it's strategy A, then that means the firefighters then put into certain tactics to achieve strategy A, or if they chose strategy B, the firefighters might put into place a different set of tactics, and is it important that firefighters know that when they arrive, it isn't always going to be, you know, the same thing? They got to have, you know, different tools in the toolbox, so to speak.
Oh, absolutely. I like the parallel of football. I'm a football fan, and I was excited to see the Huskies beat USC this past Saturday. Actually, I was more astonished than excited. But when you think the whole evolution of a football game, there's a lot of preparation. They've got a big playbook, which is like our manual of operations, if you will. And then when they hit the field, the let's say the offensive coordinator, defensive coordinator's got a sheet, not the whole game plan, not the whole playbook, not the procedure book, but just a strategic tool in that defensive or offensive coordinator's hand. When a play is called based on the situation, now they do a size up before they call a play. It's down, distance, you know, how much time's on the clock, what hash mark are they on, which side of the 50. The defensive offensive coordinator is sizing up all this information and then calls a play. Once that play is called, now that's strategy. Once that play is called, in the huddle, there's 11 people, and this even happens at the high school level, there's 11 people in that huddle that know what to do once that play is called. And within that play, all 11 players are pre-assigned. So it's not like the left guard is going to do the same thing every play, doesn't matter what down, doesn't matter if it's a pass or a run. However, when that play is called, the left guard is pre-assigned for that particular play. And then the ball is snapped, and the players are at task level. So the strategy starts with the coordinator, who decides, based on size up of the current situation in the game, of what the play is that's going to be called. So the equivalent would be the first fire officer on scene sizes up the situation of the fire ground, determines this is the correct play to call given the amount of resources I have coming and how much value there is, status of life safety, you know, is the fire first floor, second floor, high rise, what, multifamily, whatever. And then once that play is called, the players, which are your firefighters, your driver, truck company personnel, et cetera, they're pre-assigned within that play.
Well, if I could build off your analogy there to football, you know, you talk about, you know, they call the play. When they call the play in the huddle, you know, they're not providing some complete and comprehensive, vivid description of what's going to happen. They've got some shortened code or trigger words that indicate, you know, if I say this, you know, if I say this one word, it means it has a bigger meaning. So what's in play for departmental training and coordination if we see that through? Is there a way to build in plays, I guess, be, you know, using the football analogy, where, you know, if I call this play, it means you guys are going to do these, you know, these five things in this way and in this order, and then practice and train for that? Am I making sense to what I'm asking you?
I think to a degree. Now, I don't believe that you can call a play, and if you've got four engines and two ladders and a rescue, and that everybody's going to be pre-assigned there. I think that's unrealistic, thinking of my fire department. But I think you could call a play that would tell people what you're going to do without having to talk at task level on the radio. Anything that prevents you from talking at task level on a radio is the first step towards helping reduce radio traffic. If you need to talk at task level, do it face-to-face. Try and keep radio communications at a strategic level, occasionally getting down to the tactical level. Like, for example, I'll get back to that a little bit later. But maybe the first two engines and ladder can be pre-assigned when the play is called. But you mentioned something about that they don't go over, you know, in the huddle, the quarterback doesn't need to say, okay, guys, it's third and seven. We're on the right hash mark. There's 3 minutes left on the clock. It's all true, but do the players really need to know that, or do they just need to know when the play is called, this is what my assignment is when that play is called? Mm-hmm. And I think that's, you hit on it, what I think one of the big problems is that prevents strategy. Well, first of all, is the emphasis on tactical evolutions that starts in recruit school and continues right on through when you become a company officer and the training division assigns another forward lay, pull a pre-connect, you know, squirt it in the weeds type thing. But also, we have emphasize that when the first officer arrives on scene, they give a big speech. And what happens, and what I've seen happen to myself and other fire officers in my fire department, is they believe that since they give this big speech about the type of building construction and floors and fire and smoke through the windshield after the air brake goes on, that counts as their size up, because there's been this expectation to give a big speech through the windshield. I would like to de-emphasize the big speech through the windshield and emphasize getting the guy out of the cab, do a size up, and then give a big speech. Once they know what a friend of mine, Stuart Rose, says, don't try and paint the whole picture through the windshield. Paint the whole picture after you know what the picture looks like after you've got out of the cab and done your size up.
Mm-hmm.
So that means in the cab, it would be a very brief but meaningful report, arrival report. And then there'll be a speech after that officer's done a size up. Mm-hmm. That's where they'll talk about, because now they know exactly what's going on, or at least they'll have more information. They've maybe talked to somebody, an occupant, bystander, the UPS driver, or whatever, that called it in. Mm-hmm. So I think that's very important. Just think, what would that do to you as the first officer on scene if the expectation is no longer when the air brake goes on through the windshield, you have to give a big speech? To me, wouldn't that take the pressure off?
Mm-hmm.
It's anything that takes the pressure off that fire officer. Because let's Just thinking of myself when I was a company officer, in the whole evolution of a fire round operation, the person that has the most stress to perform is that first officer on scene, and they've got to give a performance on the radio that everybody's going to listen to and thumbs up or thumbs down. That they're either going to nail it or they're going to blow it. And I've found that if that first officer on scene nails it, their strategic responsibility, not through the windshield, but just nails it, you know, real brief arrival report, and then does a size up, gives a good speech after the size up, calls the play, things go much smoother than if that officer arrives and immediately goes to task level with his firefighters.
Mm-hmm. Makes sense. I think what you're offering here is a slight paradigm shift as to how we've been trained as company officers. You know, it's getting out of the tactical mindset and trying to get them up to look at the strategic. Almost the strategy is laying the foundation before they start building a walls and a roof on the incident, and pausing and making sure that they size it up properly, and then communicate a good strategy so that the firefighters and maybe other companies coming in understand what they're trying to accomplish. We're going to take a break here.
Exactly.
This is Leader's Toolbox on Firehouse.com. I'm with Battalion Chief Mark Emery of the Woodinville Fire and Life Safety District near Seattle, Washington, and we are talking on the topic of aggressive strategy. So we'll be back in just a moment.
Radio at Firehouse.com. Real issues, real answers, real firefighters.
Welcome back to the Leader's Toolbox here on Radio at Firehouse.com. Rich, if you could tell me what you've got on your travel calendar over the next couple of weeks, where some of our listeners may have the opportunity to come in and see you present live.
Thanks for asking, Pete. I've got a really busy October with lots of opportunities that have come my way, and I so much want to express my appreciation to those organizations who've given me the chance to present. I'm going to be at the University of Maryland at the Fire Rescue Institute on October 5th, giving a presentation to their executive development series. And if you want more information on that, you can go to the MFRI website, www.mrfi.org. On October 6th, the following day, I'm going to be giving a presentation to the Maryland Institute of Emergency Medical Services. And I'm presenting on two topics, dealing with difficult people and understanding motivation in emergency services. Then the next day, on Wednesday, October 7th, I am going to be at the Pacific Northwest Incident Management Symposium in Redmond, Washington, presenting on fireground command decision making. And then that weekend following, October 9th and 10th, which is, I think, a Friday, Saturday, I'm going to be presenting at an officer development symposium for the Washington County Volunteer Fire and Rescue Association in the Hagerstown, Maryland area. And then finally, rounding out October on October 31st, I am going to be presenting at an officer development seminar in for the Ponderosa Fire Department in Houston, Texas. Chief Fred Windisch has invited me down as a gracious host to presenting on decision-making and situation awareness on the fire ground for fire departments in and around the Houston, Texas area. And information for these venues and how to register and such is on my website at richgasaway.com, and then you can go to the upcoming events link, and there's information on those programs and other programs throughout the year. So thanks for asking, Pete. It's going to be a busy and exciting opportunity for me in the month of October.
Well, I'm glad you're out there and helping to help firefighters and officers kind of spread the word on a bunch of different topics that, eventually lead to everybody coming home safely. So we will add a link to all those events at the bottom of the podcast player page, so make sure to check that out, along with richgasway.com. And I'll let you two get back to the program today.
Yep. Before we get back to the program, Pete, I just want to put a shout-out to a couple of agencies where I've done programs recently. I want to show my appreciation to Salisbury, North Carolina Fire Department Chief Bob Parnell. Invited me down to present to his department. They had a double line of duty death incident in March of 2008, and Chief Parnell actually read the article that I wrote in Firehouse Magazine, the two-part article on situation awareness on the fire ground, and called me up and said, I really like the article and like for you to come down and talk to our officers about situation awareness, and yeah, it was really humbling for me to be in Salisbury and just be speaking to a group of firefighters who had lost two of their own. And Chief Parnell is a forward-thinking, visionary type fire chief, and I appreciate him and the members and officers of Salisbury hosting me and giving me that opportunity. And then also, I'd like to thank the Ontario Fire College. Doug Outram at the Fire College arranged to have me come up and give a presentation to chief officers from around Ontario on fire ground command decision-making and situation awareness. And we had about 70 people attend that program. Very interactive, lively group. It's my second time to the Ontario Fire College, and those people are just tremendously gracious hosts and incredibly knowledgeable fire service leaders. And thanks to Doug and the Ontario Fire College. And then finally, Chief Dave Fulmer at the West Licking Fire District. Dave's a board member for the VCOS and somebody that has been a professional associate of mine for more than 20 years. Invited me into West Licking to give a presentation to fire officers and chief officers from around the Columbus, Ohio area. And we had over 100 people, about 103 fire officers and chiefs attend that program. And my thanks to Chief Fulmer for hosting and for his gracious hospitality while he had me in town last week. So thanks to those folks and to everyone who gives me those opportunities. I certainly appreciate it, and it's very rewarding to be able to give back to the fire service in that way. Back to the Leader's Toolbox and my host, Battalion Chief Mark Emery from the Woodinville Fire and Life Safety District, and we are talking about aggressive strategy. Mark, how does strategy fit into the progression of fire ground actions?
Thanks. Thank you for coming back after the break, if anybody returned there. I thought it was interesting enough to return. I appreciate that. Hopefully it's just not you and me right now. But that's fine if we have a conversation.
That's something I always worry about, Mark. Is anybody out there really listening?
I mentioned earlier, just as we have tactical level hose and ladder evolutions, I think creating strategic evolutions works, and not just in training. I'm talking about on the actual fire ground. Some of the examples that we use in Woodinville, for example, is if an evolution where, let's say, what we feel is a backup team on the fire ground is more important than a rapid intervention team. In fact, I like to ask people, would your family rather have one trained, disciplined backup team protecting your egress in the building, or would they rather you not have a backup team and have a rapid intervention team on each side of the building? And invariably, everybody says, well, they'd rather I have the backup team and no RIT teams. And backup is pretty much completely ignored by NFPA, and I think it's exponentially more important than rapid intervention because it's proactive. And basically, a rapid intervention team, your hope is that you're never going to have to use it, that it's a complete waste of a perfectly good team. by signing rapid intervention. But the evolution we have that involves both, and it's also in the spirit of complying with two in and two out, which is a state law in Washington, that we get our two out standby team to go off to make the offensive transition to comply with two in and two out. Once we assign rapid intervention, that standby team puts their face pieces on and goes to backup. So the evolution, if you're going to write it out like a formula, is RIT equals standby plus backup. So what that means is we'll quickly get the two out standby team so we can make that quick offensive transition. Once rapid intervention arrives and they grab their RIT kit and all the gee whiz stuff that a rapid intervention has, when they deploy, then that two-out standby team dons their face pieces and they go on air and they enter as the backup team. So what we end up with is rapid intervention, which is fulfilling our two-out responsibility. And more importantly, we have an evolution that gets a backup team in the building protecting egress. So that's one example of a strategic evolution or a risk management evolution on the fire ground. Another example of a standard strategic evolution, let's say that it's a house fire. Unknown if occupied, standard offensive game plan is in place, and everything is going well. Got some teams in my back pocket and staging, and I get a report from truck one who's doing primary search on floor two, emergency traffic, two unconscious adults, floor two, need assistance. Well, now my incident, I'm sure you agree, it has just been thrown out of balance. Now, the rescue, the two unconscious adults on floor two, is a tactical problem. Rescue is a tactical problem. Now, if I'm a reactive tactician, I'm going to start throwing teams from staging at that problem. And each time I do that, what's happening to my span of control at the command post?
Yeah,
it's popping up one.
Yeah.
Now, if I say, okay, this is a short-term functional problem called rescue, what can I do on the strategic side to address the short-term functional problem with a short-term strategic solution? And that would be establish a rescue group. So I take a company officer, I say, your rescue group supervisor, here's truck one who's up there with the victims right now. Here's a couple other companies in a medic unit under your supervision. Hand him the passports for those companies. And then he goes and he supervises that short-term functional problem, so it's off my plate. Now, maybe I gave him three or four companies in a medic unit to deal with that, but how did my span of control change at the command post?
Yeah, you added one.
I added one.
Yeah.
I'm not overwhelmed. Short-term functional problem is off my plate. That rescue now, that supervisor now owns that short-term functional problem. Once the rescue is complete and everybody lives happily ever after, then I just terminate the rescue group and I continue on with the operation. So that's a strategic evolution that's front-loaded that, okay, if I get this short-term functional problem, I'm going to create a group to address that problem. Using a group, for example, in that particular situation. So those are just a couple of examples how I recommend addressing with standard strategic evolutions problems on the fire ground. So you can get from one place to where you want to end up strategically.
Well, your point is well made. As I think about some of the things that I have spoken with about the way commanders can get overloaded and overwhelmed with workload when they're alone and they have too many balls in the air, so to speak, and it'd be real easy if you had that reported rescue to deploy two or three additional companies and have them stay under the span of control of the incident commander, which then only contributes to the possibility of them being overwhelmed because they're having to now track and account the work being accomplished at the tactical level of all of those companies instead of just having one, adding one direct report who oversees that tactical function. So it makes a lot of sense.
Yeah, I guess it's not letting that problem, not allowing yourself to become part of the problem, but part of the solution. I know that's a lot of people have said that a lot of times before I just did, but that's exactly what you want to try to do.
Yeah.
And I think one of the ways to make, I'm sorry, go ahead.
Oh, go ahead, Mark.
I think one of the ways to do that, of course, in that whole evolution of the two unconscious adults on floor two, and handle that strategically is to obey what I call my number one command caveat, and that's if you need it, whatever that is, and it's not there and available right now, it's too late. There's no pause button in that rescue. If I don't have teams and staging ready for assignment, there's no pause button while I get my second alarm there or whatever I need to help handle that situation. Because I've got to keep going, whatever operation is still going on, plus now I got this new problem I got to deal with. And if I don't have those teams and staging in my back pocket, I'm toast. Shame on me as the incident commander.
Well, one of the things too, Mark, that came to my mind when you talked about making this rescue group supervisor is, you know, when you have when you go from searching to a confirmed victim or two, one of the things that can happen to the fire ground commander is they get goal fixated. You know, they get caught up or consumed by that single goal. Now, you know, rescue is now all that they're thinking about, and as a result, maybe other things fall off their plate, where if you make this rescue group supervisor, the commander can still stay big picture, and you let that rescue group supervisor fixate on that single goal.
Yes. It can steal the incident commander's attention away from everything else, exactly.
And that's
part of that emotional attachment that happens. That intensity level goes up, and by having these front-loaded strategic evolutions in your mind, that takes that stress away or reduces it significantly. Because you go,
Yeah, it's important to keep that commander thinking at the strategic level and not to get fixate on any single tactical operation. You know, that there be others whose attention is focused on it. Kind of reminds me of somebody says they have a good attorney because they pay that person well to worry for them. a commander maybe has these company officers who are in these roles to worry about these things for the commander, you know, to make sure that the fine details of it is done, and the commander doesn't have to come down to the level of working or thinking steps in a tactical operation. They can still stay strategic.
Yeah, and it works the other direction too, where truck one, who's on doing primary search on floor two and finds these two unconscious adults in a large house, let's say, or a multifamily, that they can't be expected to start thinking for the chief, the incident commander, saying, this is what I recommend you do. All they've got to do is basically dump the problem on the incident commander's lap with the expectation that this incident commander is going to know what to do with this problem once I hand it to him. And,
right.
And now they should know he's going to create a rescue group, but they shouldn't have to recommend that.
Right.
They should know, okay, we're going to get supported here by our I know that incident commander's got teams and staging in his back pockets ready for assignment. That, you know, they don't have to think about that stuff. They know that the incident commander's got them supported if something like this happens, resource-wise.
Yeah, this all ties together, though, for that interior officer to think or have that faith and confidence in that commander. They would have had to, somewhere along the way in training, practice that evolution and the, you know, what the commander's response is going to be when they're doing that training. And that's maybe back to the disconnect is, you know, we train on, you know, how to get inside, how to search, how to find the victim, and how to pull the victim out. But strategically, you know, are we practicing how we would have this play out, as you had described, the creation of a rescue group, deployment of some companies out of staging? Are we practicing it that way so that when we're out on a scene and we have it happen for real, it plays out in real life just as it played out in training? And I just wonder if people are really practicing that way, and you know, with consideration for strategy. So I'll leave the question to be rhetorical and let the listeners think about whether they are. But there's you know, there's a valuable lesson in that. Mark, what happens if aggressive strategy, you know, doesn't happen on the fire incident scene?
Just if aggressive strategy does not happen? Oh.
Yeah.
What happens, if you've been around a while and you've been a chief officer that arrives, you know, second or third, or, you know, generally not the first, rarely am I first on scene, unless it just happens to be somewhere around where my fire station is. And we're a small fire department, right? We staff four stations, and we play well with others. We rely on automatic aid, mutual aid with Redmond, Kirkland, and our neighboring fire departments. But what happens is the chief that arrives, if you arrive and that first officer on scene, as I mentioned earlier, has not nailed their strategic responsibility and front-loaded the incident strategically, initially, like NFPA calls it, the initial action plan, or basically initial strategy, is that the chief will arrive, and in my case, I'll start trying to chase those tactics with strategy, and it doesn't work. When a chief arrives and companies are already out there, the old term herding cats, when you arrive and you're trying to chase tactics with strategy, it's like herding cats. It's what happens is you'll find chiefs that start to buy into what's going on and try to support it, rather than if you're a defensive or offensive coordinator in the NFL, even on a high school level of football, using that analogy once again, when things are not working out very well strategically or tactically on the field, what does the incident commander or the coach do? When he perceives, boy, I'm losing control of things here on the field, Time out. Let's regroup here. Let's rethink what we're doing. We can't just keep going down this path. And I think when an incident commander or a chief arrives and is put in that position of chasing tactics with strategy, I really think the only way to herd the cats is to stop things and take 30 seconds to get things organized. And what I'm talking about is to get everybody tactically accounted for, which is a whole different topic. Maybe someday we can talk about. But basically it is so the incident commander knows who's there, what they're doing, and where they are. For every team and person, individual on that fire ground, if you're truly in command, then that incident commander knows who's there, what they're doing, and where they are at all times. Now, of course, if you've got 50 firefighters on scene, there's only one way for that incident commander to maintain that tactical accountability awareness, and that's to manage span of control, to assign divisions and groups and get companies out of the command post, get tactical level resources as much as possible, responsibility out of the command post. Because what happens basically is if you're the incident commander trying to chase tactics with strategy, and at the command post, I'm talking to Engine 1, who's somewhere on the fire ground operating. If I'm the incident Main Street Command and I'm talking to Engine 1, as soon as I start talking to Engine 1, technically I'm not functioning as the incident commander. There are a whole bunch of levels of the incident command chart between the command post and Engine 1. And if I'm way at the top as the incident commander and I'm talking to Engine 1, who's on a hose line and somewhere on the fire ground, technically, I'm probably functioning as a strike team task force leader, but since it's not a square mile fire ground, we're talking about a square foot fire ground, the structural. The people that talk to Engine 1 on the structural fire ground are division and group supervisors. That's who talks. That is the next level in the incident command system that talks to Engine 1. So if the incident, you see what I'm saying? If the incident commander is talking to Engine 1, at that precise moment, he's not functioning as an incident commander, technically.
Now, so, there's a assumption here, because I sense that there will probably be some listeners that say they understand incident management, and they understand the need to have a span of control and division leaders and such. What about these departments that are short-staffed and don't have the ability to layer their span of control as you describe? Is there any hope for them as to how to manage through this?
Oh, absolutely. And the way that happens is, in now after I say that, I'm gonna do a reality check and say that often we had a defensive fire last set of shifts I worked that I retained all companies myself as the incident commander. We only had one alarm, which was three engines, a ladder, and EMS unit. And because it was defensive, I was able, to, as the incident commander, to keep all the passports and be talking to Engine 1, for example. So you got to do what you got to do. But there are certain parameters, I think, no matter how big or how small you are, as much as possible as the incident commander, you want to focus on just three things, which are the only three things an incident commander is responsible for, and that is the management of strategy, resources, and risk. And if the incident commander is doing something that doesn't fall into one of those three categories, then the incident commander is not functioning as the incident commander. And that's fine. It's just that I think a chief needs to recognize when he's functioning as the incident commander and when the chief is not functioning as the incident commander. And remember that, you know, my main responsibility is to be the incident commander at a strategic level and not down talking to companies. But it has to happen many, many places. Mm-hmm. There's just no other way to handle it.
Yeah, that for
help
many
an
of
hour
us,
away some places, you know. So
yeah. For many of us, that's, you know, that's the reality. Is that you know, we'd welcome the chance to have, you know, the resources to delegate and have a span of control that's, you know, 5 to 7, not always the reality for everyone. I just want to acknowledge that for the listeners, and, you know, give you a chance to you know, address that straight up, because I know that there'd be somebody out there who would be saying, you know, that's really great in the large departments, but, you know, not so realistic for us here in smaller town America. Mark, what are some suggestions that you might give to fire departments about how to embrace this concept of the aggressive strategy?
To embrace the concepts?
Yeah.
I think a lot of it just starts, first of all, with expectations. And I think if fire officers understand what the expectation is, and then how to meet that expectation, so it's not just thrown out, this is what we expect of you, which is kind of what NFPA does, but they're not in the role of how to do things. They're in the role of the standards, which, you know, here's what the things that should be happening, we recommend. Now, how you get there, how you make sure the first officer on scene does a size up and drafts the initial action plan, you know, that's up to you, like you just mentioned, based on the size of your department, how many resources respond, you know, how much time it takes to muster those resources on the fire ground. But that's the first part of it, I think. And I do you have something in mind, I think, that would help yourself?
No, I was just thinking, you know, what you know, if our listeners are out there, you know, say, okay, yeah, I buy into the idea here. What are some things that they could do that would get them thinking about aggressive strategy? One of the things that comes to mind that maybe has been said, you know, between the lines, but maybe not as directly, and I'll just throw it out there directly, and I think that you probably intended this, is that when you develop training programs that are hands-on training programs, that you're out on a training ground or a live burn, or anything that you're doing that has a hands-on component, that you preload that exercise with some discussion and understanding about the strategy that is the precursor to the tactics, you know, as a suggestion for departments.
Yeah, that there is a strategic component to tactical training. You know, unless you're just going to go out and just throw a ladder, but if you're going to be doing anything that's called an evolution, that's maybe might involve another company, or like I mentioned, if you're just going to do a forward lay, you know, you grab a hydrant, you lay forward, you deploy a pre-connect, kind of the standard, squirt water in the weeds in the back of the fire station thing, that there's a strategic component to that. That rather than schedule the forward lay, you say, here's the scenario, you know what, you know, you, and now that you've been in recruit school and your firefighters have been around a while and you've been around a while, you know what the different hose evolution options are. You decide which one would be appropriate for this scenario we just handed you on this card. So there's a decision-making component to the evolution.
Mm-hmm.
And which one that... And then you can talk about, well, why did you select that evolution? You know, why did... that makes sense or doesn't make sense, or why didn't you do this first, you know, that kind of stuff.
Yeah. Well, in psychology, they talk about how a person acquires knowledge and the difference between knowing something and then understanding why you do something, and what they call in psychology terms deep knowledge. In other words, not just knowing how, but knowing why. And that's kind of tying into what you're saying, is not only knowing how to do something, but when you're told to do it, that you really understand the why behind it. We practice so much the how, but maybe we don't teach so much the why. Maybe less
exactly
to help preload some of this deeper knowledge into our firefighters. So when we say something, I often hear people say, these young firefighters today, you know, they're so defiant. They're always saying, why? Well, that why is that thirst for deeper knowledge, that deep understanding as to why things are need to be done, not just the how to do things. You know, that's their thirst for knowledge.
That's interesting. I like that. See, I learned something here today. That's great. Well, it's what you learn after you know it all. It's important, right?
Yeah, right. I learn. I'm learning every day from the people I speak with. Yeah. That's why I so much enjoy having guests on the podcast. Is it's just it's fascinating the perspectives and the knowledge that the people have been able to bring to my listeners. Mark, we're going to wrap it up here. I thank you so much for the gift of your time and addressing the fascinating topic of aggressive strategy for the listeners. Pete, I'm going to turn it back to you.
All right. Well, again, Mark and Rich, thank you very much. Mark Emery, thank you for joining us today. A lot of good insight, some things to really kind of listen to, think about it, dwell on it, and hopefully put, you know, much of it to use in your district. So thank you for joining us. If you do have any questions for Rich or Mark, send us an email to podcast@firehouse.com. And please make sure to check the links on the podcast player page, we'll have links for both Rich and Mark on some of the projects they've done for us in the past. So thank you very much.
We're also going to have a link to Mark's email. If you're interested, you know, if you're intrigued by what Mark had to say and you want to invite Mark in to present to your department, your region, your state conference, Mark is a very accomplished and well-spoken speaker on the national circuit, so there'll be access to Mark's email at the bottom of the player page. And then he also has a web presence with a website he has at www.imsalliance.com/ITAC, I-T-A-C. We'll put a link to that on the bottom of the player page, too, so you make sure that you have all the ways to check out more about Mark and to be able to reach him.
Well, I appreciate the opportunity to throw some thoughts out and have a conversation with you, Chief. And Pete, thank you for the opportunity and the privilege of contributing to the Firehouse family and the Firehouse community out there.
Okay. Pete, thanks for being our host, and look forward to talking with the listeners as I travel around. If you one of the places where I'm presenting, do stop in and say hello to me. I appreciate that very much.
If you have a comment on this program, drop us a line at radio@firehouse.com. Thanks for listening, and stay tuned to firehouse.com for more broadcasts like these, or visit our website at www.firehouse.com/radio.